Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Endothelial Function and Cardiovascular Health, From Hypothesis to Treatment, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Michael A. Weber, MD, R. Preston Mason, PhD, MBA, Vivian A. Fonseca, MD, and John R. Cockcroft, BSc, MB. Dr. Weber is a professor of medicine, State University of New York, Downstate College of Medicine, Brooklyn, New York. Dr. Weber has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Boehringer Ingelheim Pharmaceuticals, Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Daiichi Sankyo, Forest Laboratories, Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation, and Takeda Pharmaceuticals North America. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Daiichi Sankyo, Forest Laboratories, Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation, and Takeda Pharmaceuticals North America. Dr. Weber does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Weber does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Mason is an associate professor and senior research staff, Brigham and Women's Hospital, Harvard Medical School, Boston, Massachusetts, president and founder, Elucida Research, Beverly, Massachusetts. Dr. Mason has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He received grants for clinical research from AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Forest Laboratories, Pfizer, and Sanofi Aventis. He served as an advisor or consultant for AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Forest Laboratories, and Pfizer. Dr. Mason does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Mason does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Fonseca is a professor of medicine and pharmacology, Tullis Tulane alumni chair in diabetes, chief section of endocrinology, Tulane University Health Sciences Center, New Orleans, Louisiana. Dr. Fonseca has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, Daiichi Sankyo, Eli Lilly and Company, GlaxoSmithKline, Novo Nordisk, PAMLAB, Sanofi Aventis, Takeda Pharmaceuticals North America, and Zoma. Dr. Fonseca does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Fonseca does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Cockcroft is a professor of cardiology, Wales Heart Research Institute, University Hospital Health Park, Cardiff, United Kingdom. Dr. Cockcroft has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Forest Laboratories, Genzyme Corporation, GlaxoSmithKline, and Janssen Pharmaceutical Products. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Amgen, Forest Laboratories, and Genzyme Corporation. He received grants for clinical research from Atcor Medical, Forest Laboratories, and GlaxoSmithKline. Dr. Cockcroft does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Cockcroft does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to provide education on the role of endothelial dysfunction in the development of hypertension. This activity is supported by Forest Pharmaceuticals. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, I'm Michael Weber, professor of medicine at the State University of New York Downstate College of Medicine in Brooklyn, New York. Welcome to our program, Endothelial Function and Cardiovascular Health from Hypothesis to Treatment. I'm joined here today at the American Heart Association annual meetings in Orlando, Florida, by three very distinguished colleagues. First of all, Dr. Preston Mason, who's a member of the senior research staff and faculty and associate professor at the Brigham and Women's Hospital and at the Harvard Medical School in Boston. Preston, welcome. I'm also joined by Dr. John Cockcroft, who's professor of cardiology at the Wales Heart Research Institute in Cardiff. Welcome, John. He's also visiting professor at Columbia Presbyterian Hospital in New York. You've got both of those important places covered. And thirdly, we are joined by Dr. Vivian Fonseca, who's at the Tullis Tulane Alumni Chair in Diabetes and Professor of Medicine, Chief of the Section of Endocrinology at Tulane University in New Orleans. And Vivian, you also, I understand, the editor of Diabetes Care. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
Well, we have some very interesting things to talk about. Preston, there is some pretty hot data that you've been reporting, helping us to understand nitric oxide and perhaps some ways in which it might be stimulated from the endothelium.
Yes, we'll be presenting a couple papers during the course of this meeting involving mechanisms of nitric oxide stimulation by endothelial cells. We have a particular interest in the role of ATP, which is our body's own endogenous signaling molecule to stimulate nitric oxide through the P2Y receptor. And we are reporting for the first time potential involvement of beta-3 receptors in the signaling mechanisms for ATP. Because when we block the beta-3 receptor, we can attenuate to a significant degree the release of NO with ATP. So it's quite a novel finding.
It is novel, and we've known about the beta-3 receptor for a long time and wondered what it was doing. This could be an incredibly important piece of physiology you're working on.
Yeah, we're excited about it because we were able to reproduce some of the effects of ATP using a beta-3 agonist, and we were also able to stimulate ATP itself by stimulating beta-3. So there's clearly some type of crosstalk between the ATP pathway and the beta-3 receptor to enable this type of potentiation of nitric oxide release.
Now, I'm going to come back and talk a little bit more about what it is that nitric oxide, once released, actually gets up to in the vascular circumstance. But, John, let's get to something that you've been reporting on and studying for a long time, central blood pressure. How important is it? You know, we keep on hearing different studies where it's measured and perhaps is different from the blood pressure we measure peripherally. Where does it stand right now?
Well, I think it's becoming increasingly important, and it's been driven by a number of things. One, technology that now enables us very accurately to measure central pressure non-invasively from a peripheral waveform. And that's been shown to be within 1 millimeter of mercury of the pressure you can measure by putting a catheter into the aorta. So previously, you couldn't apply this to large populations because you couldn't put a catheter into the aorta of people in a population study. But we know now that there is amplification between the aorta and the brachial artery, such that in younger people particularly, they can be up to as much as 30 millimeters of mercury difference between the pressure in the aorta and the pressure in the arm. And of course, why that's important is that the heart, the brain, the kidneys don't see the pressure in your arm, they actually see the pressure in your aorta.
That's extraordinary. So it really means we may often be quite misled when we get a blood pressure in the brachial artery.
Absolutely, Michael. We've done a study, as you know, in collaboration with Cambridge, the Anglo-Cardiff collaborative trial, and we have categorized people's blood pressure in the brachial artery according to the European Society of Cardiology and Hypertension classification as normal, optimal, stage 1, stage 2, etc. And we have shown that there's an overlap of up to 70% in terms of central pressure between people who are classified on their brachial pressure as being, you know, high normal, and someone who's classified on their brachial as being stage 1 hypertensive, which suggests that we could in fact be treating people who we don't need to treat and vice versa, not treating people who we do need to treat.
All right, let's get back to that in a little more detail in a moment. Vivian, most of us in the cardiovascular realm think of nitric oxide as something that affects vasodilation and some other hemodynamic factors, but it also has some important metabolic actions.
It does, but I think nitric oxide's vascular actions are also very important in relation to the metabolic syndrome, if you like to call it, because of obesity. We know that obesity impairs nitric oxide production, partly related to insulin resistance. We know that insulin regulates nitric oxide, and that in the presence of insulin resistance, you can have a quite severe impairment of nitric oxide production, affecting flow-mediated dilatation and things like that. This is a big challenge and a huge public health problem because we've had major disappointments in the world of diabetes in terms of preventing cardiovascular disease through treating blood pressure aggressively, treating glucose aggressively, trying to get lipids to normal. And we have to think outside the box now to look at other things that would help reduce the discrepancy between event rates in diabetics and non-diabetics. So I think nitric oxide is one very important player in that area.
Okay, again, I want to come back to this as we get a little bit more clinical, a little bit more practical. But tell us, Preston, what is it that nitric oxide, everyone says how important it is, what actually is it doing in the vascular wall or next to the vascular wall?
Well, nitric oxide, of course, is a gas. This discovery was a basis for the Nobel Prize in 1998. And what we have learned from many, many studies is that it is released and then it affects vasodilation by interfering with guanylate cyclase and causing smooth muscle cell relaxation. So it has a very important role in modulating vascular resistance and vasodilation. We also, in many of our studies, in parallel measure NO release in the kidneys, in the glomerular endothelial cells, and find that changes that occur in the blood vessels are reproduced in the kidneys. So these are very important correlations. So, and I think I'd like to hear what, you know, Vivian's perspective on that, but I think what we're seeing is that it's a systemic molecule, it's very important in vasodilation, but also has very important functions in the glomerular activity.
And it's also affects the thrombotic mechanisms as well, right? It's really quite active in what you might think of as potential acute events for our patients.
Right, it has a number of anti-atherosclerotic effects. It interferes with leukocyte adhesion, platelet aggregation, smooth muscle cell proliferation, so it has a number of atheroprotective benefits beyond its effects on vasodilation.
John, we have had reports over the years of different drugs that we use for treating hypertension or other cardiovascular conditions having different effects centrally than peripherally. And there's one study that I know you've commented on before, the CAFE study. But how do we use this information?
Well, it's very interesting because, as you know, it was predicted in the 2003 European Society of Hypertension guidelines that drugs may differentially affect central pressure. And in the CAFE study was a study that was comparing older antihypertensives with newer agents. So it was a beta blocker and a diuretic against a calcium channel blocker and an ACE inhibitor. And in fact, the beta blocker was Atenolol, and the calcium channel blocker was amlodipine. And when they did that study, they did a sub-study where in the sub-study they used the SphygmaCore system, which recording a waveform peripherally, they generated the central pressure. So the sub-study included about over 2,000 subjects, and they showed that both drug regimes reduced the brachial pressure to exactly the same extent. However, interestingly, as you know, if you looked at outcome, there was a benefit in terms of all-cause mortality and stroke mortality in the perindopril amlodipine arm. And when they looked at central pressure, there was a 5 millimeter of mercury greater reduction in central pressure in the amlodipine perindopril arm, suggesting, you know, because for many years, as you know, people have said there is benefit beyond blood pressure reduction. And this trial at first glance suggested that that was true because brachial pressures were exactly reduced by the same degree in both groups. But when you looked at central pressure and the there was a 5 millimeter of mercury benefit in favor of the amlodipine perindopril arm, and that may well have explained why you got the benefit.
Fair enough. And based on that, atenolol got a bit of a bad reputation. In fact, the British hypertension guidelines said don't use this drug. Yeah. But is it fair to apply that to all beta blockers?
No, I don't think so. You're absolutely right. Atenolol got a really bad reputation because, as you know, Franz Messerli did a meta-analysis and showed that in hypertension, beta blockade actually increased your risk of death and a heart attack. But of course, and Franz, I think, would agree with me, nearly 90% of the studies that were included in that meta-analysis used atenolol. And so I think that this is very dangerous to extrapolate data.
Because there is evidence, isn't there, that some of the newer vasodilating beta blockers, and particularly nabivolol, might not have that differential effect on central BP?
Absolutely right, and that... I mean, there's two main questions. One, is it atenolol that's bad, or is it all beta blockade? And in fact, is it atenolol that's bad, or is it heart rate reduction that's bad? I mean, there's a number of ways to answer that question. But in terms of central pressure, we have done a small study where, if you look at atenolol and nabivolol, which is a beta blocker which releases nitric oxide, and we've studied them head to head. They both reduce blood pressure in the arm to exactly the same degree, but nabivolol lowers central pressure, whereas atenolol doesn't.
So that's a very
whether that will translate into benefit in outcome, but there is definite evidence that they have differential effects on central pressure, despite similar effects on peripheral pressure.
Two questions then to you, Vivian, sort of building on this clinical story. If we think of a drug like nabivolol, which does seem to be a stimulator of nitric oxide, what does that do as far as something like insulin sensitivity is concerned? And the second thing I want to come to is, do we have any evidence that this sort of action, now that Preston has raised the possibility of nitric oxide working so much in the kidney, that something that stimulates nitric oxide could have a renal effect as well?
So these are very important questions. All beta blockers are different in terms of insulin sensitization and insulin resistance. Mm-hmm. And atenolol is one of the worst in that respect. We know that there are three or four that actually improve insulin sensitivity, the real classic one of those being carvedilol. So a few years ago, we did a head-to-head study called Gemini comparing carvedilol and metoprolol in people with diabetes. And metoprolol caused some degree of weight gain, deterioration in glycemic control. So I think the take-home message is that you need to not just dismiss beta blockers. I mean, the guidelines for diabetes are very clear. When you have to use beta blockers, you can use them. But you need to be a little careful in terms of hypoglycemia, but you should also choose the appropriate beta blocker, one that will not cause weight gain, one that will not affect insulin resistance.
Yeah, is there any evidence at all that a drug that stimulates nitric oxide, could be nabivolol, could be something else, will have a beneficial renal effect?
It's possible because of blood flow. I mean, this blood flow is so important. And in terms of insulin resistance as well, there's a hypothesis that's been around for a long time that you get important in insulin delivery to the tissues is capillary recruitment.
Uh-huh.
And if you open up more capillaries, you'll be delivering the glucose and the insulin to the small vessels where you need them. And we know people with diabetes have small vessel disease. So having some impact on those kind of vessels could be very important.
President, one of the very intriguing things that you reported a couple of years ago was a study you did in healthy young volunteers, people in their early 20s, comparing young black and young white people, looking at their ability to generate nitric oxide, and showing that even very healthy young African Americans, normal blood pressures, good lipids, everything just perfectly fine and healthy about them, did not generate as much nitric oxide as young whites. Does that have an important clinical implication?
Well, it was certainly intriguing, and there is other studies showing differences in agents that stimulate nitric oxide in African Americans in terms of foreign blood flow studies, and seeing less evidence of nitric oxide-mediated vasodilation, suggesting that there may be a correlation between this change in nitric oxide and the higher risk among African Americans for hypertension and the consequences of hypertension, particularly heart failure. So in our own studies, we found that although there was plenty of the enzyme that makes nitric oxide, there was concomitantly an increase in oxidative stress, particularly in those from African American subjects. So any NO that was being produced, a lot of it was being shunted away by reacting with superoxide. So it's a very important and intriguing study. We have since gone on and looked at particular ENOS variants. Since race is only a very rudimentary way of trying to understand what's really going on genetically. So we've done some more further genetic analyses and found, and it's been reported that there are certain variants of the enzyme that lead to hypertension. So that's, I think, a very promising area of research.
It sounds very promising. And, of course, from a practical point of view, again, this beta blocker, nebivolol, that increases availability of nitric oxide seems to work quite well in African-American patients in terms of blood pressure reduction, something we don't see with other beta blockers.
Right. So in that study, we looked at two different beta blockers. We looked at two, you know, beta-1 selective agents, atenolol and nebivolol, and they had profoundly different effects on NO. We saw no increase in NO with atenolol, consistent with what John has been talking about in terms of the clinical studies. Yet nebivolol produced a very almost disproportionate effect on NO release into the African Americans compared to the whites, basically eliminating any of the differences that were otherwise there. So we think it's having an effect on oxidative stress pathways and certain aspects of ENOS function.
John, something as mundane as blood pressure itself, though for goodness sake, it's still talked about so much. There is more talk, perhaps because it was part of the registration studies for nebivolol, that it seems to work additively when given with blockers of the renin-angiotensin system in reducing blood pressure further, something we have not really seen with other beta blockers. Does this reflect an action of nitric oxide?
Yeah, it may well do, because that's very interesting, because, you know, at one time people would say you shouldn't really combine those drugs because one of the mechanisms of action of beta blockade is to inhibit the renin-angiotensin system. Mm-hmm. So it didn't seem to be a particularly good combination. And as you say, if you look at the sort of older beta blockers, it wasn't. But you're right, there is, again, data that if you combine nebivolol with an ACE inhibitor, you do seem to get
and very, very quickly, response. Getting back to the aorta for a moment,
yeah.
Can a nitric oxide mechanism be used to explain how a beta blocker like nebivolol could perhaps be causing a greater relaxation of the aorta than, say, a conventional beta blocker? Can nitric oxide work on the aorta?
Yes, it can. It's been shown very, very well in animal models. It's much more difficult to study the aorta in humans, mm-hmm. because the flow is so high and the amount of monomethylarginine you need to inhibit production would really cause systemic effects. But as you know, we've looked in the human iliac artery and we've measured pulse wave velocity directly using a catheter in the iliac artery with two pressure sensors. And we have shown that the nabivolol can decrease pulse wave velocity. We've also done it in an animal model and shown the same thing.
Oh, that's fascinating. So it really is not just microcirculatory, but in fact in large vessels too. Vivian, endocrinologists have in some ways adopted inflammatory reactions as part of the story. I know it's important in understanding what may be happening in the pancreas, but beyond that, where does nitric oxide fit in?
I think it might have some anti-inflammatory effects. That's certainly been shown. So suppression of inflammation maybe is very important in obesity, even without diabetes. So obesity is a very inflamed state. You have elevations in a wide variety of cytokines involved in inflammation. And in fact, we're doing trials right now on anti-inflammatory drugs to treat diabetes.
My goodness.
Salicylate, an old-fashioned yes. drug. We're doing an NIH-funded study treating diabetes. But I'd like to get back to something Preston said about African-Americans and also the renin-angiotensin system. We know that these patients don't respond that well in relation to kidney function, and they have the highest rates of diabetes-related
right.
kidney failure.
Right.
We became complacent a few years ago with renin-angiotensin system blockade, thinking this is going to solve the problem of chronic renal disease. It hasn't. Yes, it delays it a little bit, but with the epidemic of diabetes that we have right now, there's still a large number of patients, more than 50% with diabetes, going on to dialysis. So we've done studies in New Orleans on African-Americans who, despite adequate blockade of the renin-angiotensin system, continue to have microalbuminuria, and they have very poor endothelial function, despite giving them plenty of drugs that are supposed to correct this abnormality. And we've tried looking at the role of beta blockers in that situation.
So that could be a very interesting area for research, and thank you for sharing that with us. We've been talking about the role of the endothelium and nitric oxide in cardiovascular disease, and looking at some of the recent developments in how perhaps nitric oxide can be stimulated from the endothelium. Some very interesting new mechanisms are coming into play. We're starting to get a much better handle, too, on how nitric oxide affects the circulation, not just the microcirculation, but all levels of the arterial circulation, which, again, could be very important in understanding prognosis of many cardiovascular conditions. And we've been hearing about metabolic effects of nitric oxide, a very intriguing area, and some fascinating thoughts that perhaps as we do better at reversing endothelial dysfunction and making nitric oxide more available, conditions such as diabetes could be materially improved. I'd like to thank my three distinguished colleagues, Preston Mason, John Cockcroft, Vivian Fonseca, for sharing their valuable time with us here at the American Heart Association meetings. Thank you, gentlemen, and thank all of you for joining our program today.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME Activity, Endothelial Function and Cardiovascular Health, From Hypothesis to Treatment. To participate in the CME Activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.